You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.
Hi, I'm Rachel Walther, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show.
Yeah. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Rachel Walther. She's the author of Born to Lose, The Misfits Who Made Dog Day Afternoon. Rachel, how are you?
I'm really good. How are you doing?
I'm okay. You're like, you just asked me that 2 seconds ago when we started the taping the first time. Didn't we already go through this?
Yes.
Sometimes we have audio issues, people. Just we're all good now. We're all better. But oh yeah, so you work with what's his name? Ed Mueller? Because he even did
Mueller? Eddie Mueller.
Eddie Mueller, because
not to be confused, there's also an Eddie von Mueller. That's why I like to make that. They're both film, you know, film historians, films critics, but a very different industry. So yeah, Eddie Mueller's the film noir, the guy who runs Film Noir Foundation. He's also on TCM, the Noir Alley program. So he founded the foundation that does the festival and the magazine, etc. So yeah, it's just a great organization.
I remember maybe 25 years ago, going to some of that stuff at the Castro Theater when they were doing programming there.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. They still do the Castro?
It's still, well, now it's not the Castro. They've decamped to Oakland when the Castro closed.
And now the Castro's
renovated and turned into more of a, well, it's back, but it's now more of like a live music venue. And that was a whole local scandal that folks can Google. Mm. There was a lot of local contention because they essentially ripped out the inside and,
and the organ. Where's the organ? What did they do with the organ? That organ that used to come up and down.
Yeah, I'm guessing that's gone. Yeah. But so now it's decamped out to the Grand Lake Theater in Oakland, which honestly is a really great.
Has been
a really great host. So the festival's going better than ever. Honestly, and frankly for me, it's way more convenient because now I have a 10-minute commute to the theater rather than an hour and a half in rush hour to get to the Castro. So for us East Bay folks, it's been a nice respite to have it out here. And you know, honestly, a lot of cultural stuff in the Bay Area has switched over to Oakland, Alameda, Berkeley, etc. So it's kind of a natural evolution. But the Noir City Festival in LA is back at the Egyptian since they've renovated.
Yeah,
they're doing really well.
Have you been there since the renovation?
It's I actually got to see Dog Day Afternoon there, of all things.
My God.
Jeff Daniels introduced it as part of the TCM festival. So yeah, he was kind enough to invite me down to, and just seeing it in a packed live audience was honestly really helpful for the writing of the book, to just see the beats of when folks sort of all drew their breath in, when everyone was exploding and laughing and gauging the tense moments and the funny moments. It's so key in a theater because it's a movie where the emotions are all over the place.
And it's the reason why we still need theater, because I feel like, especially for film, when we're around other people, that the experience of the collective emotion to a scene is just, it's like going to see a play almost, but it's just like if you had like the actors come and just act it out in your living room by yourself, it's a little weird. But if you sit in a theater with other people, then that's, you get that collective experience, and you get someone like you who's writing a book about Dog Day Afternoon gets to sit there and really listen to how Sidney Lumet like really nailed that film on every level.
Yeah.
Like there is nothing wrong. I think there's nothing wrong with the film. Do you feel like there's anything wrong with the film?
No, I think that's why it was such a fun thing to write about, you know, because more often when you're hearing like making of movie stories, it's always the ones that went horribly wrong, or, you know, like Apocalypse Now, where everyone was just getting sick, it wouldn't end, or Fitzcarraldo, or what's that one, was the Island of Dr. Moreau, where the director got taken off and all this strangeness. And so this is sort of the opposite, where this was an example of all these great artists at the height of their talents coming in, collaborating in this really amazing way and creating something that was really, like, you know, greater than the sum of its parts, as you'd say. And it just, it didn't really hold up. I mean, and again, you're like watching it with a live audience, there's no parts where folks are laughing at something that's dated or ironic or funny.
Yeah.
It's still just as visceral as ever. And I mean, it's really hard for a movie to stand up that long, no matter how good it is. And so it was a really lucky pick, I guess you could say, to choose this film. And so it was just a really, it kept me in a good mood, you know, because you're reading about people doing things well and respecting one another in the process, which is rarely the case.
And so how did you get the job with no, I want to call it Noir City. What did it used to be called, Noir City?
Still is. That's the
Oh,
name.
okay.
Well, it's a little Film Noir Foundation's kind of the umbrella company that is like the proper nonprofit, and then Noir City's both the festival and the magazine. So
Okay.
that's a good yeah, that's how that shakes out. But I started working with them sort of slowly but surely. I started just going to the festival when I first moved to the Bay Area, and I was just so enamored with it. And I wrote Eddie Muller a letter out of the blue saying, "I love this festival. Here, I'm a movie person. I had worked at a video store in Chicago all through college, and you know, movies from day one in my life." And so it's, and he was really struck by that letter, and kind of that got me on the radar of the organization. But it still took, you know, a number of years until everything fell into place. And in the meantime, I had become a freelance editor and writer, and so it worked out naturally. The other editor was transitioning out of the role of copy editing for the magazine. Her and I were good friends, and so I sort of just the torch was passed to
Oh,
me
that's so
that
cool.
way. But I'd been writing for them for a number of years before that at that point. So gosh, I mean, writing for them maybe 7, 8 years now. I'd have to do the math, but and that's just been such a delight. I mean, I have been writing on my own website for even longer, particularly about film noir movies and also more contemporary crime films, like specifically 90s and 2000s, because to me that's still a really underlooked, underappreciated genre. I mean, now neo-noir is kind of hot and it's back, but so much of the focus is on 80s, you know, like erotic thrillers, William Friedkin, To Live and Die in L.A., all of that, which, I mean, don't get me wrong, those are rad, but at least for me growing up, it was the quickie straight to video stuff shot and like all the cheaper cameras that were coming out. That's really what grabbed me about sort of living in the crime movie world as an occupation. So I'm the big part of my own website was to shine a spotlight on that. Like I think the first movie I wrote about for the magazine was After Dark, My Sweet, which I think was 92, 93. I mean,
Okay,
got enough.
I never saw that. So who's in that?
That's Jason Patrick and Rachel. Oh gosh,
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. This is not a quiz show. I shouldn't have done
No,
that to
it's driving me crazy. I can't think of her last
you.
name. It'll come to me. Andrew
Yeah.
Stern. That sort of rounds out the trio. It's based on a Jim Thompson story, so it does have the full-on neo-noir bona fides, but it's shot out in like Palm Desert and it like the Indio area, and it's this really gritty kind of sun-baked thriller, directed by James Foley, who also directed Glengarry Glen Ross. So he had kind of like a hot little moment there.
Oh, okay. Wow.
Yeah, so no, those are the types of movies, or like director Nick Gomez, he did a trio of movies out on the East Coast, like Laws of Gravity, which had
Oh
a.
my God, I love that movie.
Oh, there you go. Yeah, so
Yeah,
that's.
that for some odd reason that was like on heavy play on HBO in the 90s, and
As it should
it would be on at like 3 a.m. and I would just like watch it like every single time I just watch it again. Edie Falco's in that movie.
Oh, yeah. Oh, she's so good. And she's so
Yeah.
unlike her role in The Sopranos too. It's just to see she always had that range. And Adam Trace is the sort of the loose cannon that I love him. And Peter Green, who just passed away. And so yeah, I mean,
Right.
so his films are like, and then Gomez, he
Well,
went on to do Laws, excuse me, New Jersey Drive and Ill Town. Like two Ill Town had Michael Rapaport, Lily Taylor, Kevin Corrigan, you know, like all those great like New York
so I haven't seen the other films by him. I gotta watch those.
they're great. I mean, because that's the thing is, it was, you know, it was the era you'd buy stuff ex rentals from Safeway, or you'd go to the local vid, like the squeeze and shake tape box. The tape comes out, and growing up in Arizona, just all those weird little. Sorry, this is totally an aside, but you couldn't leave tapes in your car overnight because they'd melt. I'm sure Southern California probably same problem. So it was that whole, just that whole thing. I mean, I still have my tapes of all those movies when I first got them. So it was that it so maybe there's a little bit of nostalgia baked into my, early to mid 90s obsession, but that's also when those guys, like even Wes Anderson came up, Bottle Rocket. It's got the video. That's I remember seeing that when it first came out. So it
And
was it
that
just
was fantastic when it came out. Like that was just, it was just so, I think at that time we were like so hungry for a little more authenticity in movies. And those films felt like, hey, we're right, we're like right with you. There was more of a, we're on the same page instead of you're going to witness this. It's just like, oh no, we're all together. So I don't know how they did that, but somehow.
When I think it was maybe it was probably the technology too. It was the cheap cameras and it just had that different look to it. Or like on TV, Homicide, which was actually really influenced by Laws of Gravity, same director of photography sort of put that together, that look together, I should say. But what I mean is it was just pop that like glossy alto sax bubble of 80s gluck. It was just a complete like pollution of that stuff, which was really welcome because yeah, it was no longer exclusive of this world. It was folks down the street, and you could just film in the back of your car with these little cameras and straight to cassette recording methods, or at least. And then also money was coming in, like the big indie boom because of all the movies that had been success, Crying Game and all of that. Like it just really brought in. So I'm kind of just word salading my knowledge of those movies. I don't mean to be so vague, but
Well, no, I'm loving
that
it
was.
because I'm you're reminding me of things I've forgotten about.
I
So, yes.
guess,
No,
but I
you're
mean, it's
remember,
clear because it actually
you're dealing with a fellow that's not as intelligent as you are when it comes to this stuff.
means.
So, I'm soaking it all up.
Oh, no. Well, no, I mean, there was more of an appetite also from just a funding and distribution. Like, even if you had an indie movie that you didn't get someone's help to finance, suddenly, there were studios that were willing to like stick it in theaters, or also then straight to cable was more of an option. Straight to video, or like just everything opened up in the 90s. Sex Lies and Videotape, Reservoir Dogs, like those few people, they hit something that everyone was anxious to sort of get the next hot thing. And then I run, then just as every as it does, the uncool people and the moneyed people came in and preyed on everything and consolidated all those little places. And so then it just very much got corporatized by the end of the decade. But you can still.
I vaguely remember, like after Pulp Fiction, there was like three movies that tried to be Pulp Fiction and they all died. It's just like
Well, yeah.
you can't just copy that. There's.
When it's that that's such an interest. That movie blew so many other great films out of the water. I think it just sucked up all the oxygen. But at the same time, I always want to mention like Tarantino was the first one to sort of wear his influences on his sleeve and be like, no, I got this from that movie. I got that from that movie. The Mr. Blue, Mr. Black, all that. That's Kansas City Confidential. Like, there's all these. He isn't someone who is gatekeeping with his enthusiasms, and so, and he even had a, I can't, I don't know, I don't have a deep knowledge on where how long it lasted, but he had a short video re-release label, I guess you'd call it, of bringing out rare, unforgotten films that he personally loved, put them on VHS for the first time. I can't remember what that was called, but I remember watching some of those films as well. So he's,
I think
so I feel like
Switchblade
sometimes.
Sisters was on that one.
Yeah,
I think I watched Switchblade
definitely.
Sisters because of Quentin
Yeah.
Tarantino's distribution.
I think it was just called Quentin Tarantino Presents. I think it was something like that. I remember the black label on the box. So what I mean to say, sometimes, he gets a lot of criticism for kind of like, oh, he ended the appetite for all these little indie movies. It's like, no, I don't know.
He
He's
ended all those people. They don't know
it
what they're
was just.
talking about.
Yeah, well, it's that whole thing of it sucked up so much money, and Miramax came in, and it. What I mean to say is he, things began and ended with his films, and that he shut out a lot of attention because everyone just wanted to work with him, and everything was so referential that anything that was more authentic was no longer popular. But
Oh,
I
interesting.
argue we
Go
can just
ahead.
like every, and we can just watch everything on a smash on our streaming devices, something that. We can watch Titanic next to something that someone spent $10 putting together from their iPhone on YouTube, and it's way better. There's much more egalitarian with the distribution. Sorry, I'm completely free forming here. Thank
Yeah,
you for
you should
letting
be.
me.
That's what we do. And what do you think about that though? Because now there's so much crap. It's almost like even with like novels, it's just like people, here's what people who self-publish say. I'm a published author. They put the word published in, and it's just like, oh man. And it's just like, oh yeah, because one or two people out of like 50,000 can break out of it by self-publishing because they're good. But for the most part, it's just, it's like awful ego insanity. And I don't think you could do the same with film, because with film, you got to bring a bunch of people together and you got to get it right. Even if you got cheap equipment, I mean, not cheap equipment, but you got, but the, if you have the budget way down, you still have a group of people involved that say, that's not going to work, dude. Whereas these people who self-publish novels are just like, I don't need anyone to read it because it's done.
Yeah, that's why we're writers, and that's why we're not making movies, because it's way, trying to rely on other people is just an endlessly disappointing project. So it's better to just write your books. At least that's the way I look at it.
Yeah.
Or writing about things where people have long since passed, you know, the history is more like locked into the cement of time, so you can just go back and read the room. You don't have to actually interact with people nearly as much as trying to make a film now.
So have you ever had the bug to write and direct a film?
No.
Interesting.
Well, I think maybe part of it is my dad was in, when I was growing up, my dad was freelance in the film business. And so he, not in a romantic way, but in a day rate, not getting work for months on end. Cause we were based out in Arizona. He wasn't in the industry in Los Angeles. And so he was, you know, production assistant, location scout. And so I really got a firsthand view of the long days, the tedium, the stress, and honestly, like the nastiness too, especially because, I mean, he was working in the mid 80s to, you know, late 90s that I was witness to. So it was before you couldn't be mean as much as, you know, it was before Me Too and all these reforms of, hey, maybe don't treat people like absolute garbage. So, It was just really tough and really cutthroat. And I saw the stress and sort of what it, I mean, he loved it. He was an obsessive movie person, still is. That's how I got the movie watching bug. But I saw that. I love watching them, but I'm relieved I don't have to make one.
It's so fascinating that you saw that side of it. I wrote a film and I was on set the entire time. It was a feature.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. And I'm so curious how that process went for you.
Well, the production was just fantastic. It was kind of like war and just forced intimacy by all these people. But I was lucky to be the writer with the director, and I got to see the stress of the other people on set. And I've also done a ton of extra work, like background work. I mean, I live in LA, so it's just like, you know, hey, we need a guy with a beard that like will look like he walks into a strip club, and I'm like, I would never do that, but sure, I guess I look sleazy. All right, so I get to watch other people stress out about it. The thing I've noticed about the industry in LA is people overspend. Like they get their job, or they get they get on that first TV show where they're like, oh my God, I'm the props guy for you know. TV show that just got picked up, and they buy a new car, and they get the, now they have this certain, they bring up their level of life immediately.
It's never going to end. Yeah.
Right. And then all of a sudden it's just like, oh wait, now they got to find a new show. And that's when the industry freaks me out. Cause those people are always nervous constantly because they have to keep up this new lifestyle that they created for themselves, and they can't go, oh, I got some time off. I can go work on a novel or something. So it's
I invest my money in such a way that I have a budget and a, you know, a portfolio. And some people do, and I think that's sometimes when we're like, oh, hey, whatever happened to so and so, it's like they're just enjoying their lives. You know? I think it was Matt, it stuck with me. It was Matt LeBlanc, I think, from Friends, the guy that played Joey. I think that's what he did, because they asked him recently, like, why don't you do more? He's like, I don't have to. I got my money. Wow.
Yeah.
Everything's, I mean, that's different, obviously, because he's got scads of money, but it's that mentality of, I just want to live and enjoy my life. I don't always need to be in front of the camera working 6-7 days until I'm 80. I mean, some people, regardless of whether they're a celebrity or they just run a corner store, working, you know, 7 days a week, it's some people wouldn't know how to function on any other level. They need to do that, but
Exactly. And then that's the I got to do it in a stretch of a month, and like I was like I felt like I died afterwards, just like clomp, you know. But there was a lot of emotion too, because it was my. What's that?
I can imagine. What did you were you able Were you happy with the way to literally see it come to life? I mean, that sounds like a cliche
Oh,
phrase, but to actually write it and watch them film it and
yes.
then be happy with the results too, like that just
Yes.
sounds like
No,
true.
it is, and I'm in a very low percentage of people who actually got to write their story, and then
Yeah.
people got interested in it, and then I got to be a part of the entire process. And
Yeah,
Eric
that's
was even
amazing.
t asking me stuff in post-production and sending me clips of things, and it's just like I got to be it
Oh,
was
that's
like
amazing.
I was really pulled in, and people are just like, "Wait, what? How did that happen?" And I'm like, "I got no clue, man." it was
You
like,
think it was because it was, I mean, at least I get the sense it was an independently financed, or like the finance
yeah.
came from a lot of sources. So if it was a bigger, like more, if it was like came out of the studio, do you think they would have sort of scrapped you early on in the process and
Probably,
things
and
would have been better
I was
for it?
just I was insatiably insane, and I knew I needed my finger on the project, and I even lost my literary agent because I went ahead and I was like, we got to do this with Eric Stoltz, and she's like, no, because there's no money, and I'm like,
Oh.
he gets it. The thing is he gets this, he
Yeah.
gets the story, and I think this actually gets made. So we could make a lot of money staying in development hell, or I can have something made. And I got
Yeah.
something made. Was that the right choice financially? No. Was my agent right to drop me? Yes. That she that's like I'm supposed to bring in money. That's her job to, so of
Yeah.
course. I have
Zero
no ill
regrets. I mean, oh
feelings
my
with
gosh.
her at all. What's that?
Okay. But I can't imagine zero regrets, though. I mean, you know, that whole thing of when you're on your deathbed, it's not, oh, I wish I'd have held out for 5 grand more and not had it. Of course not. You would
Right.
have to have this film and to have other people see it and touch them and they get them to experience your story is the whole point of this. And to be able to work with people, like you said, who get that and aren't going to overdo it or overdraw the characters or make them like, oh no, we need to remove the storyline entirely because it doesn't fit into our editing scheme and marketing
Well,
scheme,
we, I
etc.
mean, oh, yeah, for the edit, there were huge chunks that needed to be taken out, but that's all creative, and that's and like almost all of it I completely understand. I was just like, oh my God, there was these two young actresses that had this like major like side story, and they were just so great, and they were so cute, and then when we had the premiere in LA. And they were on the cutting room floor. They didn't even make the movie. And they showed up, and nobody had told them that that they
Oh
weren't in the
no.
movie.
Oh.
And the lead actor came up to me, Sasha, and he's like, "Oh my God, dude!" And he's just like, "They don't know." And I'm like, "Oh crap!" It was like, I felt so bad because they were so great. You know, it's just like, oh, that's one of those things where you just feel so sad that that huge scene didn't make it into the film, but. In the end, it has to serve the story of the hero. So it has to serve,
Sure.
it's, you got to stay within the confines of that, which is,
And it's one of those corny things. It's character building, like to be to be the age that they're at, to have that whole experience of being cut and to survive that and go into the next project and not be, you know, it's slings and arrows of the industry too. So it's that number.
they're doing so great now. I kind of follow them and keep up with them, and I'm like, oh, I'm like such big fans of your careers. I get to like watch, you know, and they're just so cute. And I'm just like, what if they made it into the movie and like they didn't make it as big as they did? It's you never know. But part of me wants to write and direct it like on a small level. But I, you know, I have, there's nothing I'm, I think I blew out all my passions on that movie, because I have a novel that I'm querying right now. And if they want to develop it and give me a ton of money and ruin it, oh, thank you. I'm like, I have no, I wrote the book. The book is out. People can go, hey, that was terrible, but the book's good. Or they can go, wow, that was really good. The book doesn't hold up to the movie. Either way, it's great. It's great on both ends. Just
Well, and that's why. Oh, go, sorry, go ahead.
no, just you know, I just I, now I'm looking at paydays on the film side. I'm not that
Yeah.
passion, like you say, you got to see the passion with your dad, and not the passion, but you got to see how it just being in that rotation is just you have to love it to be in it. Just like being a novelist, you have to love it to be in it because there's no money in it.
Well, and it did show me too. It didn't dampen his enthusiasm for watching movies. I will say that. It's not as though being in the industry took over, but it
Right.
also explained to me, and that's been confirmed, you know, as getting into it on sort of a film historian side, is a lot of folks that are in the industry do not care about movies. They're not movie buffs. They're not nuts. And though
Yeah.
always when my dad had an advantage, when he would be on set, like he did a commercial, I think, with Robert Richardson, and he was one of the few guys on set that knew who he was. So he was just like, glom he had glommed onto him and was, you know, reciting his filmography back. I mean, not in a totally obnoxious way, but a lot of the old timers really appreciated it, that my dad would hear a name or this and that, and they could just gab about, you know, John Garfield or the, you know, Kirk Douglas, that sort of stuff. Like they would just go on a shared topic of interest because a lot of these youngsters didn't know. And you know that happens with every generation, but
Yeah.
that showed me that you don't have to sacrifice one for one or the other, but just don't expect to sort of find a bunch of friends on set with your passions. It's like you still might be an oddball in that, because a lot of folks, you know, they're just technicians, or they're just workaday people, or they're in a
Yeah.
union, you
Yeah.
know, it's just a job. And that's okay.
Yeah.
It's But I think that's why it was interesting with this working with Dog Day Afternoon, in the sense that rather than comparing it to another creative project, it was comparing it to real life and sort of how that adaptation took place. And really, honestly, how much from start to finish that the screenwriter Frank Pearson, director Sidney Lumet, and then, you know, the actors, they really studied the real case, which I was honestly surprised to the degree that they did. The Life magazine journalist, I got to talk to one of them, P.F. Klug. He went on to write like Eddie and the Cruisers. He's in, I want to say Ohio, forgive me if I got that wrong. He shared with me that when they were interviewing folks for Life magazine, you know, within the weeks after the robbery had occurred, they did tape recordings of people. And that was key for, say, an actor like Chris Sarandon when he was building the character of the trans wife Leon, just to get the real life, excuse me, the real wife Liz Eden, cadence, her accent, her tone. Same thing with John Cazale, who played that sort of mysterious sidekick Sal, or you know, accomplice, I should say. There wasn't obviously audio recording of him because he died that night, but hearing the audio of all the tellers talking about Sal, he was able to sort of build his character based on the conflicting things people said about him, the way that what he did made them feel, what he said. So he got to soak all that up. And Lumet would then run the rehearsal sort of like a play rehearsal, you know, but he would do his own audio recordings. And so everyone could just work off of Frank Pearson's screenplay for the most part, but then riff. Lumet would then take the best bits that he heard that day, issue a new screenplay, and it sort of got the final screenplay was fashioned from there. And I asked Frank Pearson's son, though, Michael, you know, did your dad get sort of cranky about that? You know, that some of the more famous lines in the play, in the, excuse me, the film that people remember and recall, like the Attica, that was totally ad-lib. That was not in the screenplay. And then Michael said, no, he loved it. Because like Pearson, like you, like he got it. He saw that the film, again, was like greater than the sum of its parts. And the fact that everything that was ad-libbed was still done in the spirit of the story that he created. And not to mention, he won the Oscar for it. So like, he was happy. He was happy with the process. So that was nice to know that I can imagine, because I would think I'd almost get cranky if, you know, you're a writer and everyone attributes a line to you that you didn't come up with. That's odd. But just sort of all those little bits like that, like learning the interior of the clock and how it was all put together, was so much fun. Because again, yeah, it was mostly, you know, really positive experience for everyone involved in the film.
What was the story about the Attica ad lib? Because was it didn't somebody just whisper it to Pacino to do? What was that?
Yeah, it was AD Burt Harris, who I think he worked with Lumet a number of times. I think they'd done Serpico together. I'd have to double check that fact. So I mean, I think Pacino was familiar with him, and they were doing a scene outside between Chino's character who's sort of holding court in front of the bank. He's got the t his character has the teller's hostage inside. There's a huge crowd that's gathered behind the police, and he's having this interaction with Charles Durning, who plays the main cop, and just the vibe was off. The crowd wasn't reacting. The chemistry wasn't there. And Bert Harris just, yeah, leaned over and screamed, like, "Wait, say Attica." And that was something that was still really on people's minds.
Right.
Had been this siege of the similar situation, just as an aside, the when the prison, the prisoners of Attica had taken over the penitentiary, held the guards hostage, and some of the wardens, you know, the officials. And after a certain number of days of the standoff, forgive me if I'm getting the agencies, the names wrong, they basically just went in and killed everyone, put it that
Yeah.
way, the
Yeah.
FBI or whoever the entity would be. So guards, employees and prisoners alike were all just sort of slaughtered, and that was part of that sad Black Vietnam era of, oh, they don't really care about anyone or anything. They just want to maintain law and order. They just want to reestablish the rule of law. And if you're part of the if you're disposable civilian caught up in that, they don't really care. So that was really where the teller's mindset was at the
Yeah.
whole day of. So to sorry, I feel like I've got a lot of different balls I'm juggling at once. But so even though the Attica line was totally an ad lib thing, the crowd went crazy because they all
Yeah.
knew the sympathies and the sentiments of what Pacino meant when he was saying it. But then, as I was doing research, there was a journalist from the Village Voice who wrote about this case. He called the bank the night of, talked to John Wadowitz, the main robber. He wrote it up the next week in his article, and he continued to follow the case because his beat was sort of like the Greenwich Village, like LGBT scene at the time. And this was an interesting case because it was he knew John Wadowitz personally, loosely. And even in the article, it said, John's worried that they're going to pull an Attica. They want to come in and kill everyone in the bank. And
Wow.
I heard the freaking audio tape that Bell rec Arthur Bell, the journalist, recorded that night. And the main teller lady, she doesn't say Attica, but she does say, "We don't know who these police officers are. We're really
Right.
that these they had more sympathy with the robbers." They said, "These guys, they've got their back up against the wall, basically, you know, like the cops need to give these guys what they want because we don't know what they're going to be forced to do if they don't. But they're very nice men. They're treating us nicely. Just give them what they want. They're not bad people.
Yeah.
We don't want to get out of this." But they were really worried that the FBI would really just storm in and murder everyone to have done with it, because that was so much the case. So it's a long way of saying it was an ad lib, but it had all these callbacks to the real story. And that was fascinating to me, how it was just kind of in the air, I guess you could say, of the time.
Yeah, and I never t it's like almost synchronicity. I never take
Yes, that's a good
I
word.
don't take that lightly at all. It's like it's so fascinating. And when you were saying that, I just remember that is why this film is absolutely great. And anyone who doesn't like this film is just not a friend of mine, as far
I
as I'm
haven't met one
concerned.
yet, honestly. It's either you haven't
Yeah.
seen it or you like it. Again, I really lucked out. It's a movie that's very unpolarizing, I guess you could say.
Yeah. But the reason, I think one of the major reasons is the relationship of the hostages and the robbers. While usually in film it would be more like a Stockholm syndrome, like, oh, they came, or and it's not. Somehow Sidney Lumet and the writer, like, and all the actors, they created something that I don't think I've ever seen in film. Is yeah, there's the bank robbery and the heist film. It's a heist film. You can lump it in with that. But to create that intimacy where the tellers are truly worried about the hostage, about the crim about the bank robbers, and the bank robbers are like, they just want fairness. It's especially with, like, Al Pacino. He just wants things to be fair, and that's why we're on his side. And that's why this movie, I don't think this movie can ever, I don't know any other movie that has captured that little specific emotion that I can't even explain it in English, much less a language I don't know, but maybe you can. It's just that it's a different dynamic than I've ever seen in film when it comes to heist and the heist genre. Like, it's different. It's different, and it's true. There's just so much, it's honest and true across the board.
Well, a lot of it is the first word that came to mind when you're saying that is it's codependence. I think it's something that you don't see because so often, you know, the height in the heist film, the robbers are these masterminds and they've got everything timed down to the second and ticking on the soundtrack, you know, everything has this really fast and snappy mentality. But instead, it's with Pacino, it quickly devolves to, okay, who has to go to the bathroom? Who's hungry? Oh, the guard's having, you know, heart palpitation, that sort of thing. And that was something that the screenwriter realized when he started interviewing people related to the main Robert Wadowitz, who was in jail at the time. He couldn't speak to him direct, but he got the sense of this is a guy who's trying to be everything to everyone and sort of failing on all accounts. He's trying to make everyone happy, and he's not going about it in the right way, but it's the trying that is witnessed. And so that's why everyone had a lot of affection for him, even though he was in some ways, you know, kind of a really volatile guy. But then the way he was written and the way that Pacino played him out is, like you said, it's so sympathetic because he's not manipulating people into, like you said, it's not a Stockholm syndrome thing. He's not like some cult leader that's getting to follow him. It's the antithesis of that. He's sort of chameleoning into whatever he needs to be. Like there's a scene where there's a reporter calls him on in the film where the reporter calls him on the phone saying, "Why are you doing this?" And he's like, "Well, why not? I need money. Do you know how to get some money? Like, well, don't you?" And he's just asking these square questions, like, "Well, have you ever thought about, you know, just getting a job?" He's like, "Oh, you got to get a union for that. I'm not in a union. Well, what about, you know, a regular non-union position? Oh, you mean like bank teller?" And he just turns and all the teller ladies just burst out into laughter almost. "Oh yeah, you know how much a bank teller makes?" And so it's that thing, like immediately he and it was true in real life, Wadowitz worked at a bank. So that's sort of how he thought he could outsmart some of the security procedures. But he also knew what the day in and day out of a bank teller's life was like too, and how repetitive that was. And so a lot of the sympathy that's fostered in the film are through scenes like that, where it's that frustration that everyone has and holy heck, we still do for sure, of you're never going to get ahead just working hard your entire life. It's the system's been so gamed out that we can't get ahead. And, you know, Wadowitz is a Vietnam vet. This was 19, you know, 72, 73, 74. People were beginning to realize, ooh, this is not a system built and designed for our comfort. They're exploiting us. And there's so much of that that comes through in the film that I think is, again, another reason why it still sticks with us so much is because nothing's changed in 50 years. It's gotten worse.
And what's it, I, it, everything's cyclical, and it's and that's why I lo that's why I love like just the films that, like everything that comes out at that moment of time is kind of a mirror of the culture of what everyone's going through. So if we read like novels from that era and we watch films from that era or listen to music from that era, there's a collective energy that has a similarity to it. It's and it's just it's essentially humans reacting to just what's happening. It's like what's in the air, what's the collective energy right now? We're reacting to it, and this is what's coming out. And that fascinates me too with regionally too. When I like reading or even films and books by like authors from South, like say Chile or Argentina and stuff in the certain eras, and it's just they and they're so much more into like the way they tell a story is so different than the way we were telling stories and still tell stories. It's just they kind of trickle it down to you. First, I'm gonna talk to you about something. I'm not gonna bring it up. I'm not gonna bring up the hard stuff too quickly. I just wanna say hi, and they'll say hi for about 30, 40 pages, and then all of a sudden it's just like, and oh, by the way, this. And it's just like, whoa. I just love how storytelling connects us all, and I also love just the regional differences and the time stamps. I don't know when this movie came out. Was it 77? No,
75. Like, yeah,
75.
final 75. So it's in its 50th anniversary still because it came out like late 75. So
Wow,
yeah,
yeah.
it's definitely having a like kind of a renaissance. But no, like to your point, this is not only that could this only have happened in New York at that time. I would argue maybe it's only in Brooklyn too. The folks are so the main sort of players, not just, you know, the main Robert Wadowitz and his, you know, female wife Carmen, his trans wife Liz, or, you know, sorry, I'm saying the real names interchangeably with the characters, but then also the police officer, the main police officer played by Charles Durning, is such a, wiping his brow. It's a hot summer day sort of a thing. It reminds me of the main cop that Walter Matthau plays in The Taking of Pelham 1-2-3, where sort of the morality of the situation doesn't even come into play. It's like, let's just get these people safe. We've got rush hour in 3 hours. We got to just get this train moving.
Right.
Same thing with Durning. He's like, we just got to get these people out of here. We got to get everyone safe. And they're so unsurprised by everything that's going on. They're just trying to get through. Everyone's just trying to get through their day, put it that way.
Yeah.
But there's such a color and snap and crackle to it. And again, I think it's a credit to Lumet, because even like with all the tellers, the actresses who played them, I interviewed one of the ladies, Marsha Jean Kurtz, who's gone on. She was in a ton of Lumet movies. She's this great New York character actress. You'd know her when you see her.
Yeah.
Who's saying how they weren't trying to sort of impersonate the real tellers. They even just went by their real first names a lot of the time. And the wardrobe, Lumet said to the wardrobe person, "Hey, just take them out. Go pick something out at a store that you'd normally wear if you're working in a bank." And they just got two copies of that outfit. So he's like, just talk in your normal voice and react to things, if you have a speaking part, just react to something as you normally would if this was your day at work and this is what's going on. And so that's, Carol Kane's got like the two cute buns. Marsha Jean Kurtz has this cool like green polka dot thing, but they're just so comfy because that's what they would wear. They're not playing characters, they're playing themselves. And that just added to the authenticity of like folks in New York going through some stuff. This is a day in the life. And all of that, even if you don't know that going into watching the film, subconsciously we pick up on all of that.
We really do, and it's and those are the nuances that people don't understand that that's what makes a great film. It's all those the beauty. I mean, even the wardrobe, that just the wardrobe. It's like I didn't realize how important wardrobe was in a film. It's like everything. They're telling the story in their head because they've read the script. They're not just going, "Oh, we got to get a blue shirt." They're inhabiting the character and go. And they're like, what would this character wear? Okay, what's his signature color palette? Okay, so what? It's they're thinking in this way that, I guess I teach screenwriting too, and like students will write in like the clothes that their actors are wearing and or in their characters, and I'm like, do they have to wear that? Because if they don't, stay out of wardrobe department's way. Let other people do their jobs because they'll do it way better than you. Just stay to the. Stay to the scene by scene and keep going.
Unless it comes up in the dialogue or the plot, unless it's a focal
Exactly.
point.
Exactly. Yeah.
No, and John Cazale, that's why he's wearing this like ridiculous suit and those weird shoes, like these weird like kind of Cuban heeled shoes, because it's his attitude was, this is an inherently strange guy that's trying to look quote unquote normal. And what would he think that normal is, as opposed to what actually would be like a more sedate, actually realistic suit? But it's just this bizarre maroon outfit. But it to that immediately, you get this cue of this guy's kind of out of his mind, because what he thinks is not going to stand out. But he said it's even to that degree, the editor, Dee Dee Allen, she did a ton of Lumet movies. And the fact that they didn't go with a score. Lumet was just like, I don't want more music on this. I don't want to take people out of the reality of the situation. And I watched a clip where I think it was a commentary he did, say 20 years later, he hadn't watched the film in a while. And there's this big harrowing end scene at JFK Airport. And Cazale's character is sort of being taken away, and Pacino's character just breaks down and is crushed. And Lumet just like exclaimed with glee. He's like, can you imagine if we'd had music on this? It would have been terrible. I am even 20 years later, he was like delighted with his instinct not to have. So it, like you said, it's this full creative team effort, and that's why like movies are their own special animal, to where it's what just one person in that, if they'd have done it completely their way, it wouldn't have been nearly as dynamic or interesting. So it was like this special moment. And there's other examples of that too. I mean, then Lumet followed this up with Network, which could go
Oh
a whole other
man.
podcast
Well,
episode.
that's just rolling like sevens for how long?
Oh, and then he quickly, I mean, forgive me, I cannot remember what came after that. I'd have to double check, because Lumet just made one movie after the next too, but he had a very even-handed approach. He's like, well, the hits pay for the bombs. And so he made just as many movies you forgot he did. Like, I think he did The Wiz shortly after.
Oh, did he do The
Maybe not
Wiz?
directly, but like in there. And then Equus was another one in that like late 70s, early 80s period. So he
Now I
was
gotta
all.
watch all the movies I don't know by him. That's
Yeah. Oh gosh. I still haven't seen them all. I should maybe shouldn't be admitting that since I just wrote a book about him, but
we all fail.
he's one of my favorites though. I mean, oh my gosh. And then I also got to sneak in writing about Serpico in this, you know, since that's how he and Pacino first started working together. And that was one of the films that really put Pacino's name on the map. I mean, in some ways more than The Godfather, because that was such an ensemble effort. And Brando sucked up so much of the oxygen of the first one that Serpico, you know, and talk about wardrobe and that. Oh my gosh, some of the plaid.
Oh, it's so good. It's so good. And I think I had COVID. I was just really sick during COVID, and it was probably about 3 4 years ago. And I was just like feverish, and just I could barely sleep, but I could barely do anything. And I watched Serpico. The only thing that made me feel okay was watching Serpico, and I just watched it over and over again because I would just
Oh,
like be
wow.
I'd be in a half sleep state just trying to recover for a couple
Yeah.
days. And I just had the only thing that made me feel like I was still gonna live was like just hearing Serpico in the background.
Oh, that is wild. That's awesome. Wow, that's great. And that's good because it kind of jumps around in time too. So you can kind of just go in and out, and it's always the typical channel. Oh my, I know they made a short-lived TV show based on that, and
No way.
I've never been able to find a scrap of it online, if anyone knows. It was one of the things we did maybe a season. It didn't take off, but
There's so many of those TV shows out there that we can't get our hands on that didn't make it, or they just had a pilot, or they went to
yeah.
series, did 7 episodes and out.
That's the final frontier of like rare stuff. So many rare movies are cropping up, and it's just such a renaissance time, I think, for watching, which, you know, is made people think that's heresy because there's no more video stores. And having like been a video store veteran and a movie theater veteran, I feel like I have the right to say I think it's better for watching now in a lot of ways. If you're a person hunting for rare stuff, it's amazing. But no, TV is, or TV movies especially, like so many wonderful things are churning up on YouTube, but still, like that, like you said, that's like then came Bronson was one I finally found couple years. It's like a guy just goes out on his motorcycle. It's kind of like Route 66, only it's one guy on his motorcycle. It's like Route 66 meets Easy Rider kind of a thing. And it's got that, speaking of Tarantino, and I'm not going to think of his name, so this is a bad reference. The main actor in it is a favorite of Tarantino's, Michael. Oh, I'm not going to get his last name, so that's a very frustrating way to end that. He's great. He's just this like laconic, sandy-haired, very alt-American. Anyway, I'll stop there, but it's a great show.
No, this is all the fun stuff.
Yeah.
As we were talking, I was like, oh man, I gotta say blank. We were talking about
Lumet.
the Lumet TV movies. Oh, it went away from my brain, and I'll remember after we're done, and I'll be like, oh, and then I'll call you, and I'll be like, can you get back on so we can retape? And you'd be like, dude, I'm at a bar. Speaking of, how is Oakland in the San Francisco Bay Area? Do you get to San Francisco, or do you
Oh
kind of just
yeah.
stay in Oakland? Like,
To
how
add
does that work in these days?
Michael Parks was the actor I couldn't think of. He's one of those. He's like a, yeah. No, it drive me. Yeah. He's sort of like a Michael Madsen is in the same vein. Like he's a origin story of guys like Michael Madsen, only Michael Parks is earlier generation, but I'll stop there. No, I mean, to me, it's also interchangeable. I mean, I was in San Francisco yesterday. I go into SF, you know, a couple times a week for one thing or another. I mean, I know some people who, yeah, are very decidedly East Bay, try to avoid the city or vice versa. People in the city that would, but it's sometimes closer to get to different destinations across the Bay than a part of Oakland or a part of Berkeley, depending on the traffic. And I'm lucky now I have a car to use these days too. So you got the ferry, you got BART, there's Transbay buses right outside my house. So I, not to be too logistical about that answer, but what I mean is, to me, it's like if we're spending so much money to live in these creative hubs, you should take advantage of every like nook and cranny of places you want to go to. So I love San Francisco. I lived in the city for a bit over, I've been in the Bay Area 16 years, but practically it is, it's definitely been more economical to stay in the East Bay. And I landed in Alameda, which is this little island community close by downtown Oakland.
I
So
lived
yeah,
in
no, me and my
Alameda.
husband years. Oh, so you, there you go. Yeah. Isn't
I
it
just
wonderful?
I lived there for a year. 9/11
Oh.
happened when I was there, and like and it was just a weird vibe because it was a very patriotic island at that time. I don't know if it is now, but
That's kind of that those generations have rinsed out. I'll put it that way. There's been enough turnover of like rockabilly. It's the rockabilly families have moved in, so it's.
It's I just felt really out of place living there. It
I
was
can
and
imagine. Well, it has that whole base history to it, and I'm sure a lot of the old more of the old timers were around 20 years ago than now. Put it that
Like
way.
the minute
So I think those.
9/11 happened, like everybody had a huge American flag. I saw them all over the place. And I was married at the
Gosh,
time,
yeah.
and I was like, we should get a Cuban flag and just wave it to see what happens. And it's just like, I probably not, because a lot of
Oh,
those guys are carrying too.
yeah. No, yeah. I mean, I was in Phoenix at that time, so you can only imagine what that was like. Just the palpable hostility in the air of what people were gonna what you were gonna say, or also a lot, I was at the age where a lot of my guy friends were worried about getting drafted right after that, and so.
Oh, yeah. For me, that was the
You don't
Gulf
sign up
War.
for Selective Service when you're not eligible for financial aid for college. And it was like we were all about to go into college. And so some of my friends like opted not to. And so then it changed the trajectory of their lives because they couldn't go to certain colleges because they weren't going to sign up for something that might get them drafted because it was that real. Everything worked out okay. Spoiler, they all turned out fine. But it was very like harsh, hostile, unpleasant time, and still a very unpleasant place to live and be and exist. But no, Alameda is much more, you're gonna get rainbow, it's anchor flags with like rainbow on the side, the trans colors on the other side. It's very inclusive. It's very
Oh, that's
it's also the
fascinating. I should I
more
haven't been
popular.
there since 2001. Like the minute we
Yeah.
moved, because I had to, I was like, I gotta live in the city, because at the time I was doing I just started doing some stand-up comedy. So I was and I had to, I was just like, I can't go in and do a 5-minute set or a 10-minute set, commute in and then commute out. Like I need to be
Yeah.
like blocks away from these. And they had, I don't know, they used to be so many venues right around the early 2000s. And it's just like, I need to know that I can go out for, I can go do a set and be home within 45 minutes if I want to. It's like,
When transit options, even when I moved there, it was a project to get in and out of Alameda. That was the one big shift. Now it's way easier, honestly, because of like rideshare cars. So if you get stranded in downtown Oakland and the bus isn't showing up, you can, call a car and get home,
There
which
was a
wasn't.
time we had to look for yellow cabs. We had to raise our hands for yellow cabs. I miss those years because I living in San Francisco, and hailing a cab. I got to hail a cab in New York. I was in New York like 3 years ago or something, and I hailed a cab for the first time in my life in New York City, and I was like,
Oh,
oh my
nice.
God, I was just so excited, just like sitting in the cab. I was like, I wish somebody could have taken a photo of that. I hailed a yellow cab. I did it. That's,
Then you get in, there's like a commercial playing, and you're like, oh, this isn't what I thought it was going to
oh,
be.
I
Yeah, it's not like
know.
down a meter that's got a crank on it, and you're like, all the cool things about
No,
the
it's,
little chain
and everyone's it's
machine.
everyone's fake nice on Uber. It's just like, I and all that, the rideshare stuff. I'd rather have someone like screaming in Farsi at their friend. As it's just like that feels like a cab where they're like tearing down the streets of San Francisco, and you're like, well, I hope they know what they're doing, and they're screaming in another language at somebody, and it's just like, ah, home. Now it's just like, would you like a water? I don't know. We're in LA, so people are, maybe there's a different approach in San Francisco.
Oh, honestly, don't you? It's a total mix here with the. I have trouble when it's the car is really doused in cologne or like a
Oh,
scent, and then you try to like roll down the window and air it out, but then you end up kind of smell. I'm just so sensitive to that stuff, so you end up smelling like the scent because they're trying to make it nice, and you're like, I would rather have a faint smell of BO than the aquifer that I have to sort of like
Yeah.
escape out of my pores afterwards. But
Yeah.
just the fact that these are options, that was nice. You know, it's nice to. It's same thing with LA too. As someone, I often don't have a car when I'm down in LA, and so I really rely on rideshare, and just to have it as an option has totally changed what I can get done when I'm down in that part of town.
Yeah, it is crazy. You're going to be at Skylight when?
Wednesday, July 22nd. I'll be, so I guess maybe hosting is the right way to do it. Hosting a screening of Dog Day Afternoon at the Los Feliz 3. And then the books are going to be supplied by Skylight. So there'll be folks there
Oh
doing the
my
sawing
God.
and
That's going to be
the
so much
party.
fun. Oh my God. Okay, cool. The book is
Please,
called,
everyone, listen.
what's that?
Oh, sorry, no, please, everyone, yes, come out. It'll be a
Yes,
party.
yes. The book is called Born to Lose: The Misfits Who Made Dog Day Afternoon. Her name is Rachel Walther. Rachel, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
You are listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz.